Daenerys. The Dothraki name the comet Shirakia, the bleeding star. The old men muttered that it omened ill, but Daenerys Targaryen had seen it first on the night she had burned Khal Drogo, the night her dragons had awakened. "It is the herald of my coming," she told herself as she gazed up into the night sky with wonder in her heart. "The gods have sent it to show me the way." Yet when she put the thought into words, her handmaid Doria quailed,
"That way lies the Redlands, Khaleesi, a grim place, and terrible, the riders say."
"The way the comet points is the way we must go," Dany insisted, though in truth it was the only way open to her. She dare not turn north into the vast ocean of grass they call the Dothraki Sea. The first Khalasar they met would swallow up her ragged band, slaying the warriors and slaving the rest. The lands of the Lamb Men south of the river were likewise closed to them. They were too few to defend themselves, even against that unwarlike folk, and the Lazarene had small reason to love them. She might have struck downriver for the ports of Marine and Yunkai and Astapor, but Ricardo warned her that Pono's Khalasar had ridden that way, driving thousands of captives before them to sail in the flesh marts that festered like open sores on the shores of Slaver's Bay. "Why should I fear Pono?" Dany objected. "He was Drogo's co, and always spoke me gently."
"Co Pono spoke you gently," Ser Jorah Mormont said. "Khal Pono will kill you. He was the first to abandon Drogo. 10,000 warriors went with him. You have 100.
"No," Dany thought, "I have 4. The rest are women, old sick men, and boys whose hair has never been braided." "I have the dragons," she pointed out.
"Hatchlings," Ser Jorah said. "One swipe from an Arrak would put an end to them. Though Pono is more like to seize them for himself. Your dragon eggs were more precious than rubies. A living dragon is beyond price. In all the world there are only 3. Every man who sees them will want them, my queen."
"They are mine," she said fiercely. They had been born from her faith and her need, given life by the deaths of her husband and unborn son and the Magi Mirra Maz Duur. Dany had walked into the flames as they came forth, and they had drunk milk from her swollen breasts. "No man will take them from me while I live."
"You will not live long should you meet Khal Pono, nor Khal Jaco, nor any of the others. You must go where they do not."
Dany had named him the first for Queen's Guard, and when Mormont's gruff counsel and the omens agreed, her course was clear. She called her people together and mounted her silver mare. Her hair had burned away in Drogo's pyre, so her handmaids garbed her in the skin of the Hakkar Drogo had slain, the white lion of the Dothraki Sea. Its fearsome head made a hood to cover her naked scalp, its pelt a cloak that flowed across her shoulders and down her back. The cream-coloured dragon sunk sharp black claws into the lion's mane and coiled its tail around her arm while Ser Jorah took his accustomed place by her side. "We follow the comet," Dany told her Khalasar. Once it was said, no word was raised against it. They had been Drogo's people, but they were hers now. The Unburnt, they called her, and Mother of Dragons. Her word was their law. They rode by night, and by day they took refuge from the sun beneath the tents. Soon enough, Dany learnt the truth of Doria's words. This was no kindly country. They left a trail of dead and dying horses behind them as they went, for Pono, Jaco, and the others had seized the best of Drogo's herds, leaving to Dany the old and the scrawny, the sickly and the lame, the broken animals and the ill-tempered. It was the same with the people. "They are not strong," she told herself, "so I must be their strength. I must show no fear, no weakness, no doubt. However frightened my heart, when they look upon my face,
they must see only Drogo's queen. She felt older than her 14 years. If ever she had truly been a girl, that time was done. 3 days into the march, the first man died. A toothless oldster with cloudy blue eyes, he fell exhausted from his saddle and could not rise again. An hour later, he was done. Blood flies swarmed about his corpse and carried his ill luck to the living. His time was past, her handmaid Iri declared. No man should live longer than his teeth. The others agreed. Danny bid them kill the weakest of their dying horses, so the dead man might go mounted into the Nightlands. 2 nights later, it was an infant girl who perished. Her mother's anguish wailing lasted all day, but there was nothing to be done. The child had been too young to ride, poor thing. Not for her the endless black grasses of the Nightlands. She must be born again. There was little forage in the red waste and less water. It was a sere and desolate land of low hills and barren windswept plains. The rivers they crossed were dry as dead men's bones. Their mounts subsisted on the tough brown devil grass that grew in clumps at the base of rocks and dead trees. Denny sent outriders ranging ahead of the column, but they found neither wells nor springs, only bitter pools, shallow and stagnant, shrinking in the hot sun. The deeper they rode into the waste, the smaller the pools became, while the distance between them grew. If there were gods in this trackless wilderness of stone and sand and red clay, they were hard, dry gods, deaf to prayers for rain. Wine gave out first, and soon thereafter the clotted mare's milk the horse lords loved better than mead. Then their stores of flatbread and dried meat were exhausted as well. Their hunters found no game, and only the flesh of their dead horses filled their bellies. Death followed death. Weak children, wrinkled old women, the sick and the stupid and the heedless, the cruel lands claimed them all. Doria grew gaunt and hollow-eyed, and her soft golden hair turned brittle as straw. Danny hungered and thirsted with the rest of them. The milk in her breasts dried up, her nipples cracked and bled, and the flesh fell away from her day by day until she was lean and hard as a stick. Yet it was her dragons she feared for. Her father had been slain before she was born, and her splendid brother Rhaegar as well. Her mother had died bringing her into the world, while the storm screamed outside. Gentle Sir Willem Darry, who must have loved her after a fashion, had been taken by a wasting sickness when she was very young. Her brother Viserys, Khal Drogo, who was her sun and stars, even her unborn son, the gods had claimed them all. They will not have my dragons, Danny vowed. They will not. The dragons were no larger than the scrawny cats she had once seen skulking along the walls of Magister Illyrio's estate in Pentos, until they unfolded their wings. Their span was 3 times their length, each wing a delicate fan of translucent skin, gorgeously coloured, stretched taut between long, thin bones. When you looked hard, you could see that most of their body was neck, tail, and wing. Such little things, she thought, as she fed them by hand. Or rather, try to feed them, for the dragons would not eat. They would hiss and spit at each bloody morsel of horse meat, steam rising from their nostrils, yet they would not take the food. Until Danny recalled something Viserys had told her when they were children. Only dragons and men eat cooked meat, he had said. When she had her handmaids char the horse meat black, the dragons ripped at it eagerly, their heads striking like snakes. So long as the meat was seared, they gulped down several times their own weight every day
and at last began to grow larger and stronger. Danny marvelled at the smoothness of their scales and the heat that poured off them, so palpable that on cold nights their whole bodies seemed to steam. Each evenfall, as the Khalasar set out, she would choose a dragon to ride upon her shoulder. Iri and Jiqui carried the others in a cage of woven wood slung between their mounts and rode close behind her, so Danny was never out of their sight. It was the only way to keep them quiescent. Aegon's dragons were named for the gods of old Valyria, she told her blood riders one morning after a long night's journey. Visenya's dragon was Vhagar, Rhaenys had Meraxes, and Aegon rode Balerion, the Black Dread. It was said that Vhagar's breath was so hot that he could melt a knight's armour and cook the man inside, that Meraxes swallowed horses whole, and Balerion, his fire was as black as his scales, his wings so vast that whole towns were swallowed up in their shadow when he passed overhead. The Dothraki looked at her hatchlings uneasily. The largest of her three was shiny black, his scales slashed with streaks of vivid scarlet to match his wings and horns. "Khaleesi," Aegon murmured, "there sits Balerion come again." "It may be as you say, blood of my blood," Danny replied gravely, "but he shall have a new name for his new life. I would name them all for those the gods have taken. The green one shall be Rhaegal, for my valiant brother, who died on the green banks of the Trident. The cream and gold I shall call Viserion. Viserys was cruel and weak and frightened, yet he was my brother still. His dragon will do what he could not." "And the black beast?" asked Ser Jorah Mormont. "The black," she said, "is Drogon." Yet even as her dragons prospered, the Khalasar withered and died. Around them the land grew ever more desolate. Even devil grass grew scant. Horses dropped in their tracks, leaving so few that some of her people must trudge along on foot. Doria took a fever and grew worse with every league they crossed. Her lips and hands broke with blood blisters. Her hair came out in clumps, and one evenfall she lacked the strength to mount her horse. Jogo said they must leave her or bind her to her saddle. But Danny remembered a night on the Dothraki Sea when the Lycian girl had taught her secrets so that Drogo might love her more. She gave Doria water from her own skin, cooled her brow with a damp cloth, and held her hand until she died, shivering. Only then would she permit the Khalasar to press on. They saw no sign of other travellers. The Dothraki began to mutter fearfully that the comet had led them to some hell. Danny went to Ser Jorah one morning as they made camp amidst a jumble of black wind-scarred stones. "Are we lost?" she asked him. "Does this waste have no end to it?"
"It has an end," he answered wearily. "I have seen the maps the traders draw, my queen. Few caravans come this way, that is so. Yet there are great kingdoms to the east, and cities full of wonder. Yeti, Kos, Ashai by the Shadow. Will we live to see them?" "I will not lie to you. The way is harder than I dared think."
The knight's face was grey and exhausted. The wound he had taken to his hip the night he fought Khal Drogo's blood riders had never fully healed. She could see how he grimaced when he mounted his horse, and he seemed to slump in his saddle as they rode.
"Perhaps we are doomed if we press on, but I know for a certainty that we are doomed if we turn back."
Danny kissed him lightly on the cheek. It heartened her to see him smile. "I must be strong for him as well," she thought grimly. "A knight he may be, but I am the blood of the dragon." The next pool they found was scalding hot and stinking of brimstone, but their skins were almost empty. The Dothraki cooled the water in jars and pots and drank it tepid. The taste was no less foul, but water was water, and all of them thirsted. Danny looked at the horizon with despair. They had lost a third of their number, and still the waste stretched before them bleak and red and endless. "The comet mocks my hopes," she thought, lifting her eyes to where it scored the sky. "Have I crossed half the world and seen the birth of dragons only to die with them in this hard, hot desert?" She would not believe it. The next day, dawn broke as they were crossing a cracked and fissured plain of hard red earth. Danny was about to command them to make camp when her outriders came racing back at a gallop. "A city, Khaleesi," they cried. "A city pale as a moon and lovely as a maid, an hour's ride, no more." "Show me," she said. When the city appeared before her, its walls and towers shimmering white behind a veil of heat, it looked so beautiful that Danny was certain it must be a mirage. "Do you know what place this might be?" she asked Sir Jorah. The exile knight gave a weary shake of the head.
"No, my queen, I have never travelled this far east."
The distant white walls promised rest and safety, a chance to heal and grow strong, and Danny wanted nothing so much as to rush toward them. Instead, she turned to her blood riders. "Blood of my blood, go ahead of us and learn the name of this city and what manner of welcome we should expect."
"Aye, Khaleesi," said Aego.
Her riders were not long in returning. Rakaro swung down from his saddle. From his medallion belt hung a great curving arak that Danny had bestowed on him when she named him Blood Rider.
"This city is dead, Khaleesi. Nameless and godless we found it. The gates broken. Only wind and flies moving through the streets."
Jiquis shuddered.
"When the gods are gone, the evil ghosts feast by night. Such places are best shunned, it is known."
"It is known,"
Iri agreed. "Not to me." Danny put her heels into her horse and showed them the way, trotting beneath the shattered arch of an ancient gate and down a silent street. Sir Jorah and her blood riders followed, and then, more slowly, the rest of the Dothraki. How long the city had been deserted, she could not know, but the white walls, so beautiful from afar, were cracked and crumbling when seen up close. Inside was a maze of narrow, crooked alleys. The buildings pressed close, their facades blank, chalky, windowless. Everything was white, as if the people who lived here had known nothing of colour. They rode past heaps of sun-washed rubble where houses had fallen in, and elsewhere saw the faded scars of fire. At a place where six alleys came together, Danny passed an empty marble plinth. Dothraki had visited this place before, it would seem. Perhaps even now, the missing statue stood among the other stolen gods in Vase Dothrak. She might have ridden past it 100 times, never knowing. On her shoulder, Viserion hissed. They made camp before the remnants of a gutted palace, on a windswept plaza where devil grass grew between the paving stones. Danny sent out men to search the ruins. Some went reluctantly, yet they went. And one scarred old man returned a brief time later, hopping and grinning, his hands overflowing with figs. They were small, withered things, yet her people grabbed for them greedily, jostling and pushing at each other, stuffing the fruit into their cheeks and chewing blissfully. Other searchers returned with tales of other fruit trees, hidden behind closed doors in secret gardens. Aego showed her a courtyard overgrown with twisting vines and tiny green grapes, and Jogo discovered a well where the water was pure and cold. Yet they found bones, too. The skulls of the unburied dead, bleached and broken.
"Ghosts," Iri muttered. "Terrible ghosts. We must not stay here, Khaleesi. This is their place."
"I fear no ghosts. Dragons are more powerful than ghosts. And figs are more important. Go, Vashikwe, and find me some clean sand for a bath, and trouble me no more with silly talk." In the coolness of her tent, Danny blackened horse meat over a brazier and reflected on her choices. There was food and water here to sustain them, and enough grass for the horses to regain their strength. How pleasant it would be to wake every morning in the same place, to linger among shady gardens, eat figs, and drink cool water, as much as she might desire. When Iri and Shikwi returned with pots of white sand, Danny stripped and let them scrub her clean. "Your hair is coming back, Khaleesi," Shikwi said, as she scraped sand off her back. Danny ran a hand over the top of her head, feeling the new growth. Dothraki men wore their hair in long, oiled braids, and cut them only when defeated. "Perhaps I should do the same," she thought, "to remind them that Drogo's strength lives within me now." Khal Drogo had died with his hair uncut, a boast few men could make. Across the tent, Rhaegal unfolded green wings to flap and flutter a half foot before thumping to the carpet. When he landed, his tail lashed back and forth in fury, and he raised his head and screamed. "If I had wings, I would want to fly too," Danny thought. The Targaryens of old had ridden upon dragonback when they went to war. She tried to imagine what it would feel like to straddle a dragon's neck and soar high into the air. It would be like standing on a mountaintop, only better. The whole world would be spread out below. If I flew high enough, I could even see the Seven Kingdoms and reach up and touch the comet. Iri broke her reverie to tell her that Sir Jorah Mormont was outside awaiting her pleasure. "Send him in," Danny commanded, sand-scrubbed skin tingling. She wrapped herself in the lion skin. The haka had been much bigger than Danny, so the pelt covered everything that wanted covering.
"I've brought you a peach," Sir Jorah said, kneeling.
It was so small she could almost hide it in her palm. And overripe, too. But when she took the first bite, the flesh was so sweet she almost cried. She ate it slowly, savouring every mouthful, while Sir Jorah told her of the tree it had been plucked from in a garden near the western wall. "Fruit and water and shade," Danny said, her cheeks sticky with peach juice. "The guards were good to bring us to this place."
"We should rest here until we're stronger," the knight urged. "The Redlands are not kind to the weak."
"My handmaids say there are ghosts here."
"There are ghosts everywhere," Sir Jorah said softly. "We carry them with us wherever we go."
"Yes," she thought. "Viserys, Khal Drogo, my son Rhaego, they are with me always. Tell me the name of your ghost, Jorah. You know all of mine." His face grew very still.
"Her name was Lyness."
"Your wife?"
"My second wife."
It pains him to speak of her, Danny saw, but she wanted to know the truth. "Is that all you would say of her?" The lion's pelt slid off one shoulder, and she tugged it back into place. "Was she beautiful?"
"Very beautiful."
Sir Jorah lifted his eyes from her shoulder to her face.
"The first time I beheld her, I thought she was a goddess come to earth, the maid herself made flesh. Her birth was far above my own. She was the youngest daughter of Lord Leighton Hightower of Oldtown. The White Bull, who commanded your father's King's Guard, was her great-uncle. The Hightowers are an ancient family, very rich and very proud."
"And loyal," Danny said. "I remember Viserys said the Hightowers were among those who stayed true to my father."
That's so, he admitted.
Did your fathers make the match?
No, he said. Our marriage... That makes a long tale, and a dull one, Your Grace. I would not trouble you with it.
I have nowhere to go, she said. Please.
As my queen commands, Sir Jorah frowned. My home, you must understand that to understand the rest. Bear Island is beautiful, but remote. Imagine old gnarled oaks and tall pines, flowering thorn bushes, grey stones bearded with moss, little creeks running icy down steep hillsides. The Hall of the Mormonts is built of huge logs and surrounded by an earthen palisade. Aside from a few crofters, my people live among the coasts and fish the seas. The island lies far to the north. Now winters are more terrible than you can imagine, Khaleesi. Still, the island suited me well enough, and I never lacked for women. I had my share of fishwives and crofters' daughters, before and after I was wed. I married young, to a bride of my father's choosing, a glover of deep wood mutt. 10 years we were wed, or near enough, as makes no matter. She was a plain-faced woman, but not unkind. I suppose I came to love her, after a fashion, though our relations were dutiful rather than passionate. 3 times she miscarried while trying to give me an heir. The last time she never recovered. She died not long after.
Danny put her hand on his and gave his fingers a squeeze. I'm sorry for you, truly. Sir Jorah nodded.
By then my father had taken the black, so I was lord of Bear Island in my own right. I had no lack of marriage offers, but before I could reach a decision, Lord Balon Greyjoy rose in rebellion against the usurper, and Ned Stark called his banners to help his friend Robert. The final battle was on Pike, when Robert's stone-throwers opened a breach in King Balon's wall. A priest from Myr was the first man through, but I was not far behind, and for that I won my knighthood. To celebrate his victory, Robert ordained that a tourney should be held outside Lannisport. It was there I saw Lyness, a maid half my age. She had come up from Old Town with her father to see her brother's joust. I could not take my eyes off her. In a fit of madness, I begged her favour to wear in the tourney, never dreaming she would grant my request. Yet she did. I fight as well as any man, Khaleesi, but I have never been a tourney knight. Yet with Lyness's favour knotted round my arm, I was a different man. I won joust after joust. Lord Jason Mallister fell before me, and Bronze Jon Royce, Sir Ryman Frey, his brother, Sir Hosteen, Lord Wint, Strongbore, even Sir Boris Blunt of the King's Guard. I unhorsed them all. In the last match, I broke 9 lances against Jaime Lannister to no result, and King Robert gave me the champion's laurel. I crowned Lyness Queen of Love and Beauty, and that very night went to her father and asked for her hand. I was drunk as much on glory as on wine. By rights, I should have gotten a contemptuous refusal, but Lord Leighton accepted my offer. We were married there in Lannisport, and for a fortnight I was the happiest man in the wide world.
Only a fortnight? Asked Danny. Even I was given more happiness than that with Drogo, who was my sun and stars.
A fortnight was how long it took us to sail from Lannisport back to Bear Island. My home was a great disappointment to Lyness. It was too cold, too damp, too far away. My castle no more than a wooden long hall. We had no masks, no mummer shows, no balls or fairs. Seasons might pass without a singer ever coming to play for us, There's no goldsmith on the island. Even meals became a trial. My cook knew little beyond his roast and stews, and Lynette soon lost her taste for fish and venison. I lived for her smiles. And so I sent all the way to Old Town for a new cook, and brought a harper from Lannisport. Goldsmiths, jewellers, dressmakers, whatever she wanted, I found for her. But it was never enough. Bear Island is rich in bears and trees, and poor in aught else. I built a fine ship for her, and we sailed to Lannisport, an Old Town, for festivals and fairs, and once even to Braavos, where I borrowed heavily from the moneylenders. It was as a tawny champion that I had won her heart and hand, so I entered other tawnies for her sake. But the magic was gone. I never distinguished myself again, and each defeat meant the loss of another charger and another suit of jousting armor, which must needs be ransomed or replaced. The cost could not be borne. Finally, I insisted we return home. But there matters grew even worse than before. I could no longer pay the cook and the harper, and Lynette grew wild when I spoke of pawning her jewels. The rest, I did things it shames me to speak of. For gold, so Lynette might keep her jewels, her harper, and her cook. In the end, it cost me all. When I heard that Eddard Stark was coming to Bear Island, I was so lost to honor that rather than stay and face his judgment, I took her with me into exile. Nothing mattered but our love, I told myself. We fled to Lyse, where I sold my ship for gold to keep us. His voice was thick with grief, and Danny was reluctant to press him any further, yet she had to know how it ended. "Did she die there?" she asked him gently. "Only to me," he said. "In half a year my gold was gone, and I was obliged to take service as a sellsword. While I was fighting Braavosse on the Roine, Lynette moved into the manse of a merchant prince named Tregar or Mullen. They say she is his chief concubine now, and even his wife goes in fear of her." Danny was horrified. "Do you hate her?" "Almost as much as I love her," Ser Jorah answered. "Pray excuse me, my queen. I find I am very tired." She gave him leave to go, but as he was lifting the flap of her tent, she could not stop herself calling after him with one last question. "What did she look like, your Lady Lynette?" Ser Jorah smiled sadly. "Why, she looked a bit like you, Daenerys." He bowed low. "Sleep well, my queen." Danny shivered and pulled the lionskin tight about her. "She looked like me." It explained much that she had not truly understood. "He wants me," she realized. "He loves me as he loved her, not as a knight loves his queen, but as a man loves a woman." She tried to imagine herself in Ser Jorah's arms, kissing him, pleasuring him, letting him enter her. It was no good. When she closed her eyes, his face kept changing into Drogo's. Khal Drogo had been her sun and stars, her first, and perhaps he must be her last. The Meiji Mira Mazdur had sworn she would never bear a living child. And what man would want a barren wife? And what man could hope to rival Drogo, who had died with his hair uncut, and rode now through the nightlands, the stars his Khalasar? She had heard the longing in Ser Jorah's voice when he spoke of his Bear Island.
He can never have me, but one day I can give him back his home and honour. That much I can do for him. No ghosts troubled her sleep that night. She dreamed of Drogo and the first ride they had taken together on the night they were wed. In the dream, it was not horses they rode, but dragons. The next morn, she summoned her blood riders. "Blood of my blood," she told the three of them, "I have need of you. Each of you is to choose three horses, the hardiest and healthiest that remain to us. Load as much water and food as your mounts can bear, and ride forth for me. Ego shall strike southwest, Recaro due south. Jogo, you are to follow Shirakia on southeast." "What shall we seek, Khaleesi?" asked Jogo. "Whatever there is," Danny answered. "Seek for other cities, living and dead. Seek for caravans and people. Seek for rivers and lakes and the great salt sea. Find how far this waste extends before us and what lies on the other side. When I leave this place, I do not mean to strike out blind again. I will know where I am bound and how best to get there." And so they went, the bells in their hair ringing softly, while Danny settled down with a small band of survivors in the place they named Vaes Taloro, the City of Bones. Day followed night followed day. Women harvested fruit from the gardens of the dead. Men groomed their mounts and mended saddles, stirrups, and shoes. Children wandered the twisty alleys and found old bronze coins and bits of purple glass and stone flagons with handles carved like snakes. One woman was stung by a red scorpion, but hers was the only death. The horses began to put on some flesh. Danny tended Sir Jorah's wound herself, and it began to heal. Recaro was the first to return. Due south, the red waste stretched on and on, he reported, until it ended on a bleak shore beside the poison water. Between here and there lay only swirling sand, wind-scarred rocks, and plants bristly with sharp thorns. He had passed the bones of a dragon, he swore so immense that he had ridden his horse through its great black jaws. Other than that, he had seen nothing. Danny gave him charge of a dozen of her strongest men and set them to pulling up the plaza to get to the earth beneath. If devil grass could grow between the paving stones, other grasses would grow when the stones were gone. They had wells enough, no lack of water. Given seed, they could make the plaza bloom. Ego was back next. The southwest was barren and burnt, he swore. He had found the ruins of two more cities, smaller than Vaes Taloro, but otherwise the same. One was warded by a ring of skulls mounted on rusted iron spears, so he dared not enter. But he had explored the second for as long as he could. He showed Danny an iron bracelet he had found, set with an uncut fire opal the size of a thumb. There were scrolls as well, but they were dry and crumbling, and Ego had left them where they lay. Danny thanked him and told him to see to the repair of the gates. If enemies had crossed the waste to destroy these cities in ancient days, they might well come again. "If so, we must be ready," she declared. Jogo was gone so long that Danny feared him lost. But finally, when they had all but ceased to look for him, he came riding up from the southeast. One of the guards that Ego had posted saw him first and gave a shout, and Danny rushed to the walls to see for herself. It was true. Jogo came, yet not alone. Behind him rode three queerly garbed strangers, atop ugly, humped creatures that dwarfed any horse. They drew rein before the city gates and looked up to see Danny on the wall above them. "Blood of my blood," Jogo called. "I have been to the great city, Karth, and returned with three who would look on you with their own eyes." Danny stared down at the strangers. "Here I stand. Look, if that is your pleasure. But first, tell me your names."
The pale man, with the blue lips, replied in guttural Dothraki,
I am Pyat Pri, the great warlock.
The bald man, with the jewels in his nose, answered in the Valyrian of the Free Cities,
I am Zaro Zondaxus of the 13, a merchant prince of Karth.
The woman in the lacquered wooden mask said in the common tongue of the Seven Kingdoms,
I'm Quaith of the Shadow. We come seeking dragons.
Seek no more, Daenerys Targaryen told them. You have found them.